Now, what he said was, there's a lot of Japanese students at Central Washington University. They come here to study English or whatever, but I guess word has gotten around, who knows what, the world even, but Ellensburg has this distinctive blue stone called Ellensburg Blue, and the Japanese know this, and the young Japanese come in, and many times I think they come from, you know, families with money, and they know about these stones, and they buy them, and they buy them for their parents. So a young man came in one day, and he was looking at Ellensburg Blue, a young Japanese man, and the jeweler, who's this Cambodian or whatever, said he noticed around this young man's neck he had this incredibly beautiful stone object, little piece of stone on a string or something. And this Cambodian fella, young fella, said he was just so captivated by this incredibly beautiful stone. He'd never seen anything like that. And he was a stone cutter. That's what this young man was. He cut stones, so he knew all kinds of different stones, and opals and diamonds and who knows what. But in any case, he said to the Japanese, "Oh, can I see that stone?" And the Japanese showed it to him. And he said, "Where did you get it?" He said, "Well, I bought it in Japan." And he said, "Oh, fine, thank you." Well, in any case, sometime later, I think even maybe months later, this Cambodian, young Cambodian fellow, went up to the central campus to meet a friend of his. And they met near a volleyball field. And he even told me exactly where the volleyball field was. So in any case, they chatted or whatever they did, and they parted. And then this young Vietnamese walked across this field, this volleyball field, and as he did this, he spotted in the tall grass a black cord. He bent over, picked it up, and there was the carnelian, the same stone he had seen around a Japanese neck. Now, when we were in the jewelry store, he showed us this. He said, "Let me show you this stone." And he held it up to a really bright light, and it was an incredibly nice, smoky, burnt orange stone. In it, it had a kind of a lightning bolt or streak or whatever of yellow. It's just a really beautiful stone. So this fellow said that he went back to the store and he tried. He contacted the student affairs and all this, and he tried to find out, to try to return this stone to someone, this necklace, and he couldn't. He just said they couldn't trace it. You know, it was too long ago and too many students and all that. So he was wearing this incredibly beautiful stone. And I said to him, when he told me the story, I said, "You know, you saw this stone, and you just loved it. You thought it was so beautiful. And then somehow you're walking across this field and stumble on it." I said, "That was really magical." And that's the way I think of it. I think it's a sort of a magical story. And Michael said, "And you know, if someday this fellow returns and who knows, years from now maybe, and says, 'Oh, I used to have one like that,' or 'I lost one when I was—'" Margo said, "Well, you know, you could return." He said, "Well, I certainly would, but in the meantime," he said, "I always wear it around my neck." And the punchline for me, at least, of this story is, it was so nice, I wanted to rip it off the neck and run out the store.
Today is July the 21st, and Quentin and I were talking today at one time about telephone numbers, and I remember the telephone number in our house when I was small, 7, 8 years old, and my telephone number was 446.
And I remember our telephone number in Nuremberg, Germany, or Furth, Germany. We really lived in Furth, Furth, which is sort of a suburb of Nuremberg. But it was 73126. That was our telephone number, 73126. I remember living in Jersey City when a baker's dozen was 13. And I wonder if that prevails anymore, if you could go in and buy a baker's dozen or a dozen rolls or something and get 13 of them. I suspect not.
I remember that when I was a little child, the butchers gave bones away, and my mother would go in and get some bones and bring them home and make soup with them.
What about liver? I heard something about they used to give liver away for dogs.
They did give liver away. If you had a dog, you could go in and you could tell them that you wanted the liver, and they would give you the liver for the dog.
I remember the price of a movie. I'm just certain when we lived at Wilkinson Avenue, the price of a movie was 9 cents. Plus a penny tax. I don't know who had the tax on movies. I mean, you could go see a matinee, two movies, and News of the Day and a cartoon or a serial. They used to have serials in those days. Or take all afternoon to go see this for 10 cents. I'm fairly sure that when we lived in Florida, a haircut was 25 cents. And I positively know when I lived in Brooklyn, you could get a haircut for 35 cents. And Margot used to sing a song when she was a child, and she'll now sing you this ditty.
We didn't sing it. It was a little poem. It was a shave and a haircut, two bits. Who is the barber? Tom Mix.
Tom Mix, of course, was a famous cowboy of the 30s. Two famous shaving stories from our childhood. I remember you used to be able to buy shaving cream in a tube. It looked like a toothpaste tube. And it didn't foam or anything. It went on sort of like, a kind of a thick cream, almost like a skin cream of some sort, but thicker. And I remember once my father actually shaved with came out and said, I just had this terrible shave. And he actually shaved with toothpaste, or so we think, and mistaking it for the shave cream. And Margot has a memory of her father shaving, so you should tell them the story. Tell them the story.
My father used to use a straight razor, and he would sharpen it on a razor stop, which was a big, thick, heavy leather strap. And he would stand there and sharpen the razor by moving it back and forth across the razor strap.
Very rhythmically.
Very rhythmically. And then he used a shave cream that was a piece of a round thing that fit in a cup, and it was like soap. And he would stick his wet brush in there and swirl it around and get some lather up and some suds, and then he would brush that on his face. And when we were small children, if we would go into the bathroom or bother him when he was trying to shave, he would play with us by chasing us around the house trying to put shave cream all over us. It was great fun.
I don't think my father knew how to drive a car. As far as I know, he didn't. We never owned a car, and I'm just fairly certain we never owned a telephone. Now, you might think about being raised in a family where the father didn't drive, or the mother for that matter, and where the family did not have a telephone, not ever.
Not only didn't Quentin have a telephone or a car, neither one of us ever had television sets. We only had radios, and they were funny-looking radios at that.
I think the first television set we had was a black and white, small size, and I think the only reason we even bought it was because I went to Korea, and that was like, I think, 1959, if my memory's right, and just to give Margot and the children something to watch while I was away overseas, and that was our first television set, I think, 1959.
The date is July the 24th or 25th, which is it?
4th, I think,
1997.
I just want to give establish some background material that will establish these Irish stories which we have. As a university professor, we were allowed to take sabbatical leaves, although you really had to apply for them. They weren't automatic in any case. You had to sort of justify them. But we were allowed to take a leave of absence from the school, from the university, about every 7 years or so. And I elected in 1978 to go to Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. So I came up with a whole list of things I wanted to do there. And I should add that I think sabbatical leaves are a good idea. I think teaching is such an intense activity. If you're going to do it well, you can't do it year after year after year. I think some of these helping jobs like nursing and teaching and I don't know what, policing maybe, you really do need a break, or you just get so burned out that you can't do them anymore. So I think sabbaticals are justified, even though obviously they're expensive for whoever's paying for them, in this case the state of Washington. But they're justified because they allow the teacher, in my case, to refresh themselves and get away from teaching and learn some things, because you don't do them just to screw off, you do them to learn. So we decided we'd go to the Republic of Ireland, and we did. We just flew over there and flew an airplane, and then got landed at Heathrow and jumped on an Irish airplane and went to Dublin. And I think it's kind of exciting and shows you our mindset, that we absolutely, A, didn't know anybody in Ireland, and B, didn't have any place to stay. We just were, I mean, we were just like immigrants almost, and we didn't have a lot of, we just had, pretty much we carried what we had. I think maybe, I forget now, I think, almost think we sent a trunk of platinum pants.
No, or, we did not.
Margot said, no, we didn't even do that. And we just landed, and we, of course, Margot and I view these things as an adventure, and we were, I suppose, adventuresome pilgrims, if you will, and it was a fun trip, and we loved it there. So here we plopped down in Ireland. We had some little bit trouble getting into the country because the English controlled the immigration into the country, and they said, well, how long are you going to stay? And you know, the usual answer is 3 weeks, we're on vacation. I said, well, we may stay a year. And he said, well, I can't do that. We had some problems along the line, but he allowed us into the country anyway. And this is the establishment, I guess, the base for a lot of Irish stories, which I'm sure over the maybe months or years we can spread out on tape. But we simply went to Ireland, two people. I was around 50, and Margot, obviously, a little younger than that. And on an adventure, and we had a lot of fun, and we would do it again in a minute. One of the things we became interested in when we traveled to England was stonemasons' marks. Now, the history of stonemasons' marks is incomplete. And I'm not sure they've ever tied in a stonemason's mark with a name. But in any case, the story runs something like this. They think mostly the stonemasons were illiterate men. They didn't read or write. And they kept track of how much work they did by, you know, cutting the stones. They put a mark on them. That is a geometric or a little symbol thing. On the all their stones they carved, and then maybe at the end of the week or month or whatever, they went around and counted how many stones had this particular mark, and that's the way they were paid. Now they've had traced, some people have traced stonemasons' marks from, you know, the same mark found in two or three cathedrals. Now Margot and I became interested in these stonemasons' marks, and we started searching around, and they're not easily found. You have to sort of be patient, because often when the stone was laid, the stonemason's mark was put, was hidden, was not on the outside, was put on the inside. But we had great fun looking at these, and I have a fair number of photographs, especially from Wells Cathedral, of stonemason's marks. Now, it just seems from my memory is that there's a lot of stonemason's marks from Salisbury Cathedral, and I'm kind of hoping that this is 1997, and we're going to England in about 2 or 3 weeks, actually, with Ethan. I'm hoping that we can discover some stonemason's marks in Winchester Cathedral. In Salisbury Cathedral. Now, Margot wants to say a few words about bell ringing, and that's another fun story we have.
Kathy and I both read Dorothy Sayers' mystery called The Nine Tailors. And The Nine Tailors is a mystery concerning bell ringing. And bell ringing in England is very old, and well, it's kind of difficult to describe, but they have different rings, and the rings have different names. And of course, Dorothy Sayers' book has the name of one of the rings, which is Nine Tailors. The rings are performed by people pulling on the bells, and they have a certain rhythm and a certain tone and all kinds of regimentation about this. Well, I had read this book and I was completely fascinated by bell ringing. And Quentin and I were in England traveling around, and one night we spent the night in a rather small place. And we were taking a stroll in the evening around the village. And
was the town Ely, like E-L-Y?
It could have been Ely. I really don't remember.
I think it was.
But anyway, we were strolling around, and all of a sudden, I heard these bells ringing. And the bells were repeating themselves. So they were starting, and then they were stopping, and they were starting, and then they were stopping. And I said to Quentin, "Quentin, this village has bell ringers, and they're practicing, and we've got to find this church, and we've got to find the bell ringers, and we've got to watch them doing this." So that's what we did. We went through the village, we hunted down by the sound, where it was coming from, we found the church, we went inside, we wandered around inside until we saw the place where the bell ringers were actually working. We watched them pull the ropes as in Well, they don't pull them in unison. They pull them by the tone and the sound that they want to achieve. We watched all of this. There was a director telling them, no, you did that too fast. No, you need to slow it down, da, 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 da. And it was just absolutely fantastic. Now, the thing about this is, Kathy had read this book also. So later on, when we were once again in England with Kathy and John, and we went to a kind of a small village, I said, you know, we ought to try and see if there's some bell ringing going on here. And Kathy said, oh, I would love it. So we wandered around kind of, and all of a sudden we did hear it. We heard it. And I said, Kathy, that's it. We've got to go find this church. And we did. We found the church, but the church wasn't built in such a way that we could actually watch the bell ringers doing their thing with the bells. But Kathy did get to hear this, and it was just wonderful.
Footnote. I am just absolutely positive. If we lived, Margo and I lived somewhere like an English village, that Margo would be a bell ringer. I'm sure she would volunteer to do this chore. I just absolutely know this is a fact. Horsepower. Now, Margot's mother tells a story about being courted by Margot's father. He went to a livery stable and bought a buggy. Rented a buggy, and they went courting in a buggy. And that story is not hard to believe because she was born in the last century, but when I think about horses in my early life, it's surprising how many horse things are in my life. And let me give you some examples. One, when we lived in a place called 1 Cady Avenue. I remember the address. And when we moved, my father, I guess, contacted a junk man. Now, what junk men were is they had typically a wagon and an old beat-up nag, and they rode around the city, and they bought up, I don't know what they bought, rags and old metal and anything that maybe they could salvage or sell. They were sort of, I kind of almost think of them as a poor man's moving garage sale. And I remember my father hired a junk man to come to our house, and I had not the slightest idea of what my father sold this guy. But I do clearly remember, and I don't remember how I did this, but I clearly remember riding next to this guy on his horse. I thought that was really great, go clippity-cloppity-clippity down Cady Avenue to go to my house, and he was a junk guy, and he was going to go buy all this junk. Now, the other horse things I remember is this. I'm fairly sure I remember that bread was delivered in Jersey City with horse-drawn wagons. Dugan's Bread, it seems to me Dugan's Bakery, I think was the name of it. The other thing is, there were people that sold ice. People had refrigerators. They had ice boxes. They didn't have refrigerators. And these ice men would come around the neighborhood, and they would they would sell ice, and they would be on horse-drawn wagons. And you could buy a 15-cent piece of ice or whatever, and I remember these guys, they had put these ice tongs in it, put the ice on their shoulder, and they always carried a burlap bag up there, it was always soaky, soppy, wet, and they had to put a piece of ice in your ice chest I think you'd buy a 10-cent piece or a 25-cent piece of ice. I also remember that there were produce dealers that came around. Mm-hmm. So through the town, and I think they were, although maybe not always, but I think often they were like specialized. They would come around with a load of bananas, and they would just be this wagon load, one horse thing, with just loaded with bananas, and they would sell, you know, bananas door to door, and you know, you'd buy a dozen and give you two dozen for free or whatever, you know, it was always kind of a scam. And there is, in fact, a famous story called The Price of Tomatoes, which has to do with a man rushing a load of tomatoes from someplace like Texas up to New York City that, so he could sell them, you know, beat the market and get them on the market. And I think they did that. I think sometimes they sold all kinds of produce. And I believe in Baltimore, this still goes on. I think the salesmen are called Arabers. Now, I'm not sure of that, but I think they're black men with the wagons, and they go around and sell fresh produce and whatever. I guess the point of all this meandering is that there's a large part of my life, early life, that just somehow with the horses connected with it, and sort of it almost sounds like this is like 1890, but it really wasn't. I was born in 1929, but there was a lot of horsepower in my life.
Horses also drew the milk wagons when I grew up in Bay City.
Mm.
The milk was delivered by a horse-drawn wagon.
Is that right?
That's right.
Today is, what's the date today? 26th of July, 1997. The horse story continues. I can clearly remember in living in Jersey City, the garbage collection wagons, at least in some parts of town. Now, I don't remember garbage being collected up by trucks at all, but I do remember these horse-drawn, I think maybe four horses and a whole team of guys and these wooden wagons, big, high-sided wooden wagons, collecting garbage in Jersey City, all horse-drawn horsepower. Now, to continue, in World War II, of course, all over the world, not just in the United States, the men were drafted into the armies, the women went to work in factories. That was a major shift in, you know, how everyone lived. And then children were put to work too in the war effort. And that's true of all over the world. I know a woman professor here at Central, and she lived in England. She was in fact German, but she went to England and as a young teen, and she told me how she worked in the field harvesting whatever, sugar beets or something during the war. Well, in any case, the government recruited young people in the summertime to go work on the farms in the United States. And I think maybe as early as, I think perhaps 1943, I was about 14 years old, I volunteered and I was hired to go work on a farm. And I went to a place called Cuba, New York, C-U-B-A, which is in the extreme western part of the state of New York. I don't know how they sent me there or anything. They just said, go there, and I took a train, and I didn't. I think they paid me $1 a day, if my memory is right, and found, which means they gave me board and keep. I worked for two different farmers there. In succession, one was a quite old guy, and I should talk more about that at some future date. And then I worked for a second, quite younger man. But both of them used horsepower, and what I learned to do while I worked on the farm. Here I am, like 14 years old. I'd never been around horses in my whole life. I learned how to harness a team of horses. I could put the whole harness on them, horse collars and the whole business. I could hook them up to wagons or whatever, because or sleds, because they also use sleds And by a sled, I mean two logs split in half for runners. Ironwood is what they use, ironwood. And then they'd nail on or bolt on a box, a big box. This box, I suppose, I don't know what, 6 feet square. And they would use that to muck out the barns. And so I learned to harness horses, and I also learned to work horses. And I cultivated corn, for example, behind behind horses. And I think that was sort of incredible because no one does that anymore. Finally, I do have one memory, and surely not many people can even talk about this much anymore. But while I was in New York, I always thought it was upstate New York, but it was really upstate to a New Yorker. But I saw a team of working oxen, you know, just like out of an old 1937 movie, with it. They were yoked together, and the big wooden collars they had. Very slow moving, but this farmer had a yoke of oxen, and I remember it was Jehoa. That's how you tell them to go right, go right, go right, go left, go left. You say G, 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 and these oxen would go. And surely you can't find that much anymore in the United States.
Okay.
Margo and I were talking, and she told me a little story. I suppose she had told me before, but I don't remember it, or didn't remember it, and I thought it was fun and we should record it. We lived in Denver when I went to school there, and Margo got a job at the Federal Reserve Bank. She'd never worked at the Federal Reserve Bank before, and they hired her, and they just loved her, of course, and told her she could work in any Federal Reserve Bank in the country. But one of the things they told her is, some manager of some sort told her, that he said, you know, when we look back, he said, you know, we really didn't want to hire you because we thought you were too old. And we both sort of grinned and said simultaneously, you know, no one would ever dare say anything like that in this day and age. That simply, it might be true, but they would never tell you that was a consideration being too old. P.S., the year we went to Denver was in the fall of 1968, and so Margo was like, how old?
38.
She was 38 years old, and that was too old for the job. It's Sunday evening.